Are you talking about Mr. T?
I felt like my own tactics were being used against me. E.T. was at a full sprint, coming my way, Travis and Justin hot on his heels. Would have been hard not to spot Tommy and I squared off. At least I was. What's going on here? B.T. asked breathlessly. Ask him. I've got some wounds that need tending. I walked off, but not before I caught a shrug from Tommy. Dad? Travis asked. I'm all right. Get everyone inside. We have company coming, and not the kind we want to entertain. Zombies! Gary yelled from under his perch on the roof. Son of a bitch, I said under my breath as I turned around. Two lone zombies stood far out in the field looking our way. Scouts. Then a few more marched up. This continued for another half an hour, until there were zombies as far as the eye could see. It looked like we were going to have our own battle here, though I didn't think there would ever be enough people left to come on a pilgrimage and look for trinkets left over. In fact, there might never be anyone to record it. How many massive battles through time must have been waged that were never retold? There was no reason whatsoever to believe the ancient civilizations that had risen and fallen before recorded history were without their own bloody conflicts. The moment Flunt stumbled onto the much more spacious cave of Vart, there was war. It was pretty coincidental that moments after Payne's departure, an army of zombies showed. Just because she denied her involvement didn't make it true. That's interesting, Deneau said smugly as she flicked a make-believe ash off of the straw she was not smoking. She was looking over the field, as were we all. What are they waiting for, you suppose? She asked. Probably their boss to make her safe departure. Or his, she said softly. She looked about to ask another question. I was not in the mood and went inside. Tracy was there. She had Wesley in her arms. I think I need some help. I was suddenly feeling lightheaded. I fumbled with the buckle to my rifle and harness. I took them off and then peeled my shirt off. My God! Tracy exclaimed. I hadn't thought any of the wounds too vicious. That was until I looked at the dark red lines radiating out from them. Bitch poisoned me. I sat. I was getting weaker by the moment. By now, most of the inhabitants of the inn had come into the main room. They're not moving, Justin had run into the room, but stopped talking when he saw me. Justin, get the strongest proof liquor you can find and a towel, Tracy ordered. She helped me lie down and placed a pillow under my head. Travis, get Tommy. I wanted to tell her I didn't want him here, but my throat was beginning to close up, to the point where breathing was going to be difficult soon. I shook my head. It was a three-way tie as Travis, Justin, and Tommy came to skidding halts in the room. Tommy's cool touch brushed my forehead. He has a fever. He traced one of the wounds before saying, Vervain. I thought he was speaking a Latin swear. It's an herb often used to ward off or even kill vampires. It has varying effects depending on how it is introduced into the system. Do something, Tracy beseeched, as the lines marched upwards towards my heart. There is very little we can do. This fight is his own. How long? B.T. asked, thinking about my recovery and now the very real threat of a zombie invasion. I don't suggest moving him. We need to set up an IV, get some fluids in him, get him upstairs and into a bed, make him comfortable. My body felt like I was being stung by a hive of angry hornets. Not an inch of me didn't feel on fire. The fever was intense. At times I thought I might burst into flames from the heat of it. I drifted in and out of consciousness, sometimes waking to the fevered pitch of a battle being waged, to screams and commands of those around me. A good amount of time I was dead, or dead to this world anyway. I traveled the highways and byways of Dreamland, Coma Town, out of Itsville. You yet live, Payne whispered. She appeared before me in a long, flowing blue dress. It had a high white trim collar, and her bodice cinched tight, showing her more than ample bust and narrow waist. There was hardly an inch of her exposed. yet the presumption of what was underneath those clothes could stir many a loincloth. It is painful, is it not? The vervain, I mean. I had to be careful even collecting it. I poisoned you with enough of it to drop you where you stood. Perhaps I have underestimated your will. Charity came up alongside Pain. She wore a white dress with tassels that looked more in tune with something a flapper from the Roaring Twenties would wear. Her body was no less perfect than Pain, though she liked to put much more of it on display. Times change. Are you shocked to see my sweet Charity? Alas, this is the only place we can still communicate. The bullet has left her physical body in a state of disrepair. Here, though, she is still free to roam. He is weakened, and he is in our territory, Pain. Stop toying with him. Kill him now, and end the threat. Are you so sure, sweet sister? What are you talking about? Charity asked. Are you so sure this is our territory, and our territory alone? He is here. That speaks volumes. I was a fan of Payne's cautious approach because, if they attacked, I wasn't sure I could do much except cheer them on in the hopes they would finish me fast. Look, even now he finds a way to defend himself. Payne looked amused. I watched incredulously as a sword formed in my hand. The pommel was a deep golden color, and the blade shone bright as the morning sun. I still said nothing. I was afraid my voice would betray me. A quiver in tone could be all that Charity needed to force the issue. If he is so powerful, why is he in need of a weapon? Charity sneered. Do you not recognize the blade? Payne asked. That is Dawnsetter. The blade blessed by the... I know the blade, Charity snapped. It has bitten deep of our kind. He has no right to wield it. Do not upset yourself, little one. We will strike. Some other time, Payne said. That was all I needed to hear to get my indecisive ass into gear. I refused to be hunted. I thought about saying something dramatic like, "We end this here," in some authoritative Viking-type voice. But why? I was already at a disadvantage. A quick, unexpected strike might be the only thing that turned the tide. Tough not to telegraph your moves when the very weapon you were swinging takes up half the room and shines as bright as the morning sun and all. But I was up, and I'd halved the distance. Pain was already on the move, separating from Charity, getting to my swordless side. Charity was a little slower on the uptake, but she still had plenty of time to avoid my charge. My swing missed her by a foot, maybe more. You were as clumsy as an oaf. In a realm you should be as graceful as Quicksilver. Shit, I muttered, when I watched Pain rise up into the air. She hovered 10 feet above my head. It got no better when Charity did the same. Didn't need to read The Art of War to see where this was going. They now had air superiority, the old high ground. Odds were pretty good they were going to attack. I did not have the luxury to wait and react. Acting without direction was now my default mode. Maybe always was my default mode in whatever realm I found myself in. I swung that blade up and around. Pain had to veer abruptly to avoid being struck. "Still think I'm oafish?" I asked, when she stared angrily down at me. "Now how's that for superior war brains? Egg on one opponent with your back to another. And women, no less." Charity hit me with an impact that looked and felt like a charging rhino slamming into a safari jeep. My back was jarred and my neck whipped, causing my brain to rattle around in its housing. I knew in my head that as soon as I hit the ground, Charity had me. She would rip into my neck like a jaguar would a deer. Then a funny thing happened. Well, not so much funny as fantastical, magical, bordering on the miraculous. I was wondering how hard dream ground was, just as my face was about to be blasted into it, when there was nothing. No concrete, no asphalt, no hard-packed earth, no grassy surface, just nothing. I spun completely around. Charity had, at some point in my revolution, been thrown from me. I didn't think about the hows or the whys. I didn't think about reacting. I just did. She was looking up at me, and I swung that sword, striking her in the shoulder. The blade bit deeply. It came to a rest just above her breast. The scream she let loose was savage. It ripped at my ears. Her eyes glowed a bright red as her fangs elongated. Her right hand reached over and grabbed the sword. She cried out even harder as she touched it. As loud as Charity's cries were, they were nothing to the primal war scream pain let loose as she attacked. For someone incapable of love, she sure was pissed. She hit me hard enough I had to reset my teeth. I was wrenched away from Charity, my grip sufficiently tight that I took the sword with me, which made a particularly horrific squelching sound as it was removed and amplified her screams. My mind was far too addled to once again alter the ground. This time I skidded along it, face first, for nearly 20 feet. When I righted myself, pain and Charity were gone. Exhausted didn't even begin to explain my sorry state. The sword dissolved into nothingness. My arms felt as if they were made from stone. I sat down, convinced that I now found myself in an atmosphere of heavy gravity, and I was very much in danger of being melted to the ground by the extreme pressure. I lay down, as this was the only position that allowed any form of comfort or end to the vertigo that threatened to spin me off my feet. Right now, Wesley could have beat me to death with a rattle, and there wouldn't have been a thing I could do about it. I awoke some time later to the smell of cordite and smoke. A scent I was all too familiar with. Spent gunpowder. I craned my neck around. I was in bed. Tracy was at the window, leaning out and firing. I sat up, expecting my head to be swimming in a sea of misery. Surprisingly, I felt great. I know, right? What does that say about you, that on any given morning you expect to wake up feeling like shit and then are genuinely surprised when you don't? Still, we take the good surprises with the bad. My wife was shooting at something while I lay there. I tossed the covers to the side and stood, stretched, gave the normal ball scratch, and walked over to give Tracy a kiss, as if this was part of our regular routine. I wrapped my arm around her waist and put my head on her shoulder, careful not to disrupt her aim. I looked out the window. In terms of a battle, this one was nearly finished. Zombie bodies were strewn all over the lawn and parking lot. She was busy picking off those lucky few who appeared to be moving away. "You're awake," she said, happily enough. "Everyone all right?" I asked, dreading anything but one answer. "Everyone is fine." Something made her look over her shoulder at me. She frowned. "Michael, you realize you're not clothed, right?" "Oh, motherfucking hell," Talbot, BT yelled from the doorway. He held an ammo can-clad hand in front of his face. "Have you no fucking modesty? Shit, it's not even that. We're in the middle of a damn zombie battle, and you aren't going to be able to do much with that weapon." "Fucking ouch, man. That just hurts." I made sure I was facing him in full frontal mode. "Fucking deviant." He put the ammunition down and walked away. "Well, it seems my weapon worked well on him." I had my hands on my hips and sent him off with a pelvic power thrust. "No, you did not just do that." Tracy had placed a cupped hand over her eyes. I got dressed, but only because it seemed the right thing to do in this particular situation. By the time I was done and had grabbed my rifle, it was all over except the cheering. I would have to time more battles like this one. Good strategy. This was a strange attack. Tracy turned to me as I raised my rifle at the window. There wasn't a target worth wasting a bullet on. Chapter 12. The Battle for Cemetery Hill. After weeks of peace, the zombies had followed Mike and the others up to the inn. BT had Travis and Justin lock all the bottom floor shutters, and then they had barricaded the front door, in expectation of an attack that had yet to launch. The zombies had mustered 50 feet from the entrance. "What are they doing?" Gary asked, peeking from one of the windows. "If they had candles, I would almost say it was a vigil," Tiffany said.
"For who?
Why would they do that?"
"I didn't say it was a vigil. I said it looks like one," she replied.
Winters and BT were standing by a small conference table discussing how they should proceed.
"Anything?" BT asked Gary.
"Nothing.
They're just standing there," Gary said. "They're waiting for the night, or for some, what do you call them, bulkers?" Winters posed.
"Possible," BT said. "But they're not usually shy or cautious in regards to attacking. They pretty much go balls out once they've got a target."
"Let's give them something to think about before they do, then," Winters said.
"I'm all for killing zombies," Tommy said, still visibly shaken up by Mike's accusations. "But if we start firing, that might spur them into action."
"You're saying we wait? Wait for what?" Winters asked. "For them to get more reinforcements? For the dark? For the earth to split open and swallow them up?"
"They're zombies. Doesn't matter what it looks like, they're here to kill us. They're not pondering if they should kill and eat us, they're just pondering when."
"Sorry, Tommy, I'm with Winters on this one," BT said.
"How's Mike?" he asked, as he saw Tracy coming down the stairs.
"Resting, but far from comfortable. Tommy, I'd like it if you were up there. It seems the vervain poisoning has stopped spreading, but I can't tell. The discoloration doesn't look so great."
She looked tired and extremely worried.
Tommy went upstairs. Justin followed, Avalyn in his arms.
"They've stopped?" Tracy asked, referring to the zombies.
BT nodded.
"There a reason why we haven't started firing yet?" She cocked her head at them and frowned.
"None that I can think of," BT replied. Dano came down the stairs, a half-chewed straw in her mouth.
"I want a cigarette so badly I could walk out there and pull one off a zombie and strike my match across his face. That being said, I just might. I would prefer it was dead, but I could take my chances. How about we kill a few so I can look over some corpses?"
The waiting was over. Retreats were rare, and reinforcements seemed a more likely outcome. The word was given, and a few minutes later there was at least one rifle in every second-floor window.
"Fire!" BT shouted from the middle room, making sure he was heard throughout the inn.
Gunfire erupted. Zombies fell in droves. Heads exploded. Chests ripped open. Arms and legs blown off. Yet still the horde did not shift. After 5 solid minutes of wrecking their front lines, BT called a ceasefire. Except for the zombies that had been obliterated, none of the others had budged. They did not look at the dead at their feet. They did not look to the inn where the ferocious and barbaric shots had come from. The nothingness, the absence, was disturbing in its own right. BT now had to weigh options. How many rounds did they expend on an enemy that did not seem interested in the conflict? Thanks to Sanders, they had replenished their stock and then some, but he wouldn't pour water out in the desert merely because he had plenty to drink.
BT turned as he heard Michael cry out in pain.
A moment later, Travis ran past the room to check on his father. Tracy was with her husband. She would call out if help was needed.
"They're coming!" Winter shouted.
BT whipped his head back around.
"Just a coincidence," he whispered as he pulled the trigger.
By the time they stopped advancing, the shooters were firing nearly straight down. Then, inexplicably, they began to pull away again. BT watched as they made a slow, apathetic retreat, making sure this was not some kind of ruse. He wanted to check on Michael. He used the excuse of an ammo check to do so. He wasn't sure why he needed subterfuge or even what he was looking for, but when he saw the man up and about and in good spirits, his suspicion of a correlation was confirmed. There was a connection between his most trusted friend and the strange behavior of the zombies. But what kind of connection? What did any of this mean? For surely there was a relationship, right? The zombies had come when pain showed. What if Michael somehow defined their purpose?
They had stood outside in vigil while he was sick. They had advanced when he had cried out, whether in pain or for help. Then they had pulled back. Realizing what? That he was all right? Chapter 13. Mike Journal Entry 13. I got dressed, went out to the porch, and watched as the last of the zombies receded. Tough to call it a retreat. Not something they generally do. Feeling better, Mr. T? Tommy asked. He seemed so sincere, I felt guilty that I had accused him of trying to kill me. I saw pain and charity, and no, it wasn't a hallucination. I was traveling in the astral realms. And? He asked. Charity is wounded on this plane, and pain gave me an indication that she may never heal. But she was all tigress in there until I wounded her. What does she want? Pretty sure it's to kill all of us. Isn't that generally what vampires want? Not all vampires, he replied. BT came out onto the porch. Happy to see you with some common decency, he said, referring to my pants. Don't act all coy and shit. You liked what you saw. Kinda scared you, I goaded. Fine. Since you opened this conversation up in that manner, I'm going to bring out the big guns, he replied. Don't, man. Don't do it, I said. The only Talbot I want to see naked is your sister. Tommy snorted at that. I may have turned a slight green. You been hanging with my wife, I asked. She teach you to bring a tank to a thumb wrestle? Ain't got time for your games. I'd like to talk to you, BT said. And he looked serious. I looked over to Tommy, who got the message, and walked back into the inn. BT laid it on me, what he'd witnessed. I had nothing I could add. If I somehow had a measure of control over the zombies, sure, I'd use it to wipe them out. But I certainly wasn't aware of anything big. In a pinch, I could maybe direct three or four to do my bidding. Simple stuff. But that oily, disgusting feeling I got by linking with them was not something I relished doing, and I had avoided it altogether for a good long time now. I'd rather lick the seat of an ill-tended gas station toilet, and we all know that just wasn't going to happen if you needed a conclusive image to follow my sentiments. Is it a subconscious thing? He asked, reaching. Maybe you don't even know you're doing it. It doesn't work like that, BT. There's all this concentration, focus, reaching out. It'd be like trying to fly a plane subconsciously. What the fuck is going on, then? I'm worried about Tommy, I said. If I couldn't say it to him, then I couldn't say it, period. In what way? Is he in danger? No, I'm more worried about the danger to us. From the kid? Really? Just a feeling. Couple of small things. He left me hanging there for a minute. I can tell you this. While you were out, he swore up and down he didn't know she was out there, for sure. And he was even more vehement that he had not seen you pass. And I believed him. I have a pretty good instinct when someone is lying, or even half-truthing. My understanding is psychopaths have no tells, that a lie does nothing to them physiology-wise. You're saying that kid is a psychopath? He's been with us since the beginning. You don't think someone would have noticed? I don't know what I'm saying, okay? But first off, he's not a kid. He also had an extended stay with his sister not all that long ago, and there's no denying she was a psychopath. Mike, think about what you're saying. That kid, okay, man, vampire, whatever, has saved all of us multiple times. If he wanted us harmed or dead, he could have achieved that just by some inaction on his part. He would not need to do anything overt, and no one would even question him on it. You're right, I finally said. You're right, it's me, man. The accumulated stress of all this, I'm starting to see shadows in the corners of brightly lit rooms. As much as we all needed this break, a way to heal and decompress, maybe it's a sign that we should get moving again. Yeah, it's a scary thing when we give you too much time to think. I couldn't even deny his words. He'd meant them as a joke, but there was a fair measure of truth to them. Idle hands might be the devil's workshop, but an idle mind can be the birth of hell itself.
Even with the threat of pain around and the strange zombie invasion, we had still found solace at that place, a measure of peace we had not had since the beginning. 2 days later, we packed up. We had enough food to make the trek by horse-drawn cart if need be, and enough ammunition to fight off a city-sized horde. The only thing lacking could be the one thing we'd always had in excess. Hope. It took an immeasurable toll every time we lost someone. Death is a finality. You can never recoup the loss. There will always be something unique about that individual. Their wit, charm, the way they smiled, or the way they made you smile. Hell, even their silence when others spoke. Those people aren't just gone. When they go, they take something from you as well. Something tangible that can never be replaced. That's why they say you miss them. There's something missing now besides another body. How many holes can you have in your heart before you begin to bleed out? It seemed to be a question we were all reluctantly and rapidly facing, searching for that number. But this was no Tootsie Pop with a gooey, chocolatey center we wanted to get at. BT and I headed out the next morning to Dr. Mary Jane Bones. If I'd made that name up, you would not even believe me. She wasn't the closest obstetrician, not by a couple of miles. But come on. I had to. Like I was compelled. It was an upscale medical building. A couple of plastic surgeons shared the place as well. It was in remarkably good shape, but there wasn't going to be many people coming to get a nose job or to check on why the missus couldn't get pregnant during a Z-Pog. There were no zombies, no people, and no vampires. Perfect trifecta. Door's locked, BT said, pulling on it. Well, I guess they're closed. Maybe we should just go then, I said. Is it hard being that much of an ass? I meant I was going to have to bust the window. Be prepared for some noise. He grabbed a decorative flower pot full of dirt and some weeds. Thing had to have been 100 pounds. He hefted it up onto his shoulder and heaved it a good 10 feet. The resultant noise and shock wave was felt 3 counties over. Holy fuck, man, maybe you should have just shot it, I told him. Anything within a mile is going to come check on it. Sorry, he said rather sheepishly. I didn't think it was going to be that loud. Yeah, who's the ass now? Still you. Always you, he said. We cautiously went in. Nothing looked out of place, or better yet, smelled bad. On the initial hallway were 3 doors. I went into the first one, Dr. H. Tuckman. This is a plastic surgeon's office, BT said, following me in. I walked past the reception area into the records room right behind. I pulled open a drawer and started flipping through some files. Talbot, what the fuck are you doing? Oh, wow, he said, getting closer when I handed him some before and after photos. This guy is like an artist, I said, as we looked at some of his handiwork. For a solid 5 minutes, I kept handing off photos to BT. He dropped his stack and grabbed my shoulder. Come on, we've wasted enough time. Wasted? Admiring art is no waste of time. Not like this is the Louvre, and I'm sure your wife would be thrilled to hear about why this trip took so long. I'll miss you, patient 5642, I said as I put her file back. Dr. Mary Jane's office was a bright blend of pinks and baby blues. She had an entire wall devoted to photos of all the children she had helped bring into the world. I couldn't help but wonder how many of them might still be alive. So many, I said, walking past the pictures. BT had found the file room and was scouring files. Mike, come on, man, there's got to be thousands of files here. I'm going to need help. BT had a growing stack by his feet of women that were not viable candidates. Each of them had already had their child or were conclusively incapable, as the case may be. I grabbed my first file and had just flipped it open when I looked across the room. Done, I said. Really? You open one fucking file and we're done. He grabbed it from my hands quickly. The hell are you talking about? She had her kid 10 years ago, he said as he read the sheet. I was walking to a cabinet that said samples on it. Mike, I looked at the damn booby pictures. The least you can do is help me with this. When did you get so narrow-focused? Oh, I know what it is. You still have too much blood running around in your little man. What? What the hell are you talking about?
and me and you were standing entirely too close for me to be comfortable getting them. Well, you know what I mean. I wonder what my sister would say if she knew you got tumescent looking at other women's breasts. Tumescent? You talk like a third grader most of the time, and then you throw a word like that out. What the hell is wrong with you? No, I wasn't tumescent, you sick bastard. Let's just find a house we can go to and get some damn vitamins. He was getting angry. It's okay, my stiffened friend. It's a natural reaction. Men are very visually stimulated. Did your dad not have to talk with you? We can go over the basics if that helps. I did not have a hard-on, he roared. I want to get the fucking vitamins and go. Fucking vitamins? That a code word for Viagra? I mean, because that's a whole other set of problems. You seem young for that kind of issue, but all that anger could be blocking up your chi. Don't worry. Breathing techniques, maybe a little yoga, could clear that all up. He flexed for a fraction of a second. Probably best I wasn't standing behind him. I could be eating my words right about now. I have to think the world would be a better place if I just spun your head off. The prenatal vitamins, he said slowly and succinctly, hoping I wouldn't find a way to distort his words. I just want the prenatal vitamins, he sighed. Done, I said, stuffing a pile of them into the backpack I had with me. Huh? What? He asked as I walked by. You have got to be kidding me. Why couldn't you have just said something? It's a 2-foot by 2-foot clear display case that has 6-inch letters that say prenatal vitamin samples. Should I have done some hand flourishes around it like Vanna White? You could have tried, but she's much prettier than you. Can we go now, or did you want to grab some souvenirs from Tuckman's? I didn't need to turn around to realize he was flipping me off. I could feel the wind whip past my ear from the way he forced his finger into the upright position. We were back at the inn in under 2 hours. Might be a record for us. I didn't want to say it was too easy, because that implied that we were being set up for something right around the corner. I wouldn't have minded in the least if all of our runs, hell, if half our runs went that smoothly. It was rare to have a complete success, and even rarer to not have to fight or avoid serious danger. Any problems? My sister asked when we came back. You should have used a thicker loaf of bread, BT said. What? Lindsay was completely lost. I smiled. I'm thinking he wished you had smacked me harder or with something bigger when you hit me with the frozen pita bread. Was he giving you shit? Lindsay asked BT. Your brother is a childish, mean little man, BT said, hugging my sister. Her back was to me, so not only was he freely flipping double eagles, but he was also sticking his tongue out. Oh, look at you making friends, Tracy said to me as she came into the room. BT did his best to hide his gestures. It was about as effective as a kid with chocolate streaks down his face, denying he'd eaten the cookies before dinner. Chapter 14 Mike Journal Entry 14 On the road again, Gary sang out from the back seat in a key I wasn't even sure was measured on the musical scale. Does he realize how bad he sounds? Tracy murmured from the passenger seat. She was doing her best not to show Gary she was plugging her ears. All the possessions we've lost, and somehow he holds on to a Walkman. I had my window rolled down, hoping the 70-mile-per-hour air rushing in would drown out my brother's crooning. It didn't. If anything, it made the sound twirl around the car and directly into my right ear. We all had our own unique ways of dealing with the problems this life was handing us. Mine generally involved an extra heaping of sarcasm steeped in large doses of alcohol. Gary liked to sing. It was the only time he was truly happy, the only time he could push his demons away, or at the very minimum, temporarily scare them off. The road was surprisingly clear of monsters and people. Not debris. There was plenty of that. I couldn't imagine that it would be much longer than 10 to 20 years before car travel would no longer be possible. Not to say with the way things were going we'd still have cars. We were already coming across stores of gas that were gumming up. Wouldn't be too much longer before we had no fuel. Sure, we could shift to diesel, but that would only buy us another year, Max. Even if we used some sort of hybrid fuel or electric car, the rubber in the tires was only going to be good for so long before dry rot set in. Once you added the breakdown of roads no longer being maintained, we were facing the end of America's love affair with the automobile. In reality, we had maybe a year or two more of driving wherever we went. Our kids would never drive. I almost choked up at that thought. I understood that civilization was already on the ropes, but that would be one big nail in the coffin. Not just because some of my fondest memories centered around road trips and backseat romantic encounters either. Without rapid transportation or a means to communicate, great swaths of the country would become isolated. Wouldn't doubt it if we started to revert back to the old West. That was, of course, if people made it that long. Mad Jack had scoured the country looking for settlement, and the only one of note was Etna Station. I know there were pockets like ours, family groups banding together, fighting for our humanity. But tied off from all others, they would inevitably begin to choke and die off. I hated to admit it, because for most of my life I had tried to put as much distance as I could between myself and the rest of humanity, but we needed each other if we wanted to survive, if we wanted to come out the other side. Deneau pulled up alongside me. "You should take these two," she was referring to BT and Lindsay. "I've seen teenagers less handsy." "Not gonna happen, and you've given me less of a reason to do so." I rolled up my window and pulled ahead. We were making decent time, and as we rolled from Indiana into Illinois, I could not help but think back on Camp Custer and the destruction that had been wrought there. Was I even now racing ahead to a new base? Would I be considered this age's Typhoid Mary? Would I be considered this age's Typhoid Mary? I mean, if you got down to the brass tacks of it, we had one vampire following us. There were two vampires in our midst, two people who maybe didn't have the zombie virus in them anymore, but definitely had been exposed, and a baby delivered from a zombie. That was a lot of potentially disruptive variables brought into a community that I'm sure had a very delicate ecosystem. I wondered if it was morally necessary to warn them about us. "I'm worried about what our presence could potentially mean for Etna," I said, finally putting words to my fears. Typical Tracy, she immediately picked up on what I was thinking. "Custer wasn't your fault, Mike. You can't blame what happened there because of you or us. Eliza brought that storm to them. But I led her there. If not for me, there's a chance that place would still be thriving. How many people lost their lives that day? How many countless others who never had a chance to find that sanctuary? We knew she was following us, just like Payne is now. I can't bring another wolf into the henhouse. I won't allow it." "What are you saying?" "We need to stop her, to kill her before we get there. Or at least I have to. There's no other choice." "How? How are you going to do that?" "She told you herself she can strike whenever she wants to. We have no idea where she's at or from what direction she'll come." "She said that, but she's a predator. She's wary. She's not going to attack when we're at our strongest. She's going to wait. She'll stalk. Maybe pick off some of our weak," I said, and my thoughts immediately went to Ryan, who was just barely walking now. "She'll strike when she knows her odds of success are at their highest." An idea began to percolate in my head. I had to trust Tommy. I would need him on this 100%. Well, I'd need all of us, actually. How we were going to pull it off with the threat of her watching would be the tricky part. But I was thinking I had the perfect spot to set up an ambush. We could be rid of that threat, at least. There was still Knox, but he was human and insane, the devil we knew. And he wasn't insane enough to attack a well-armed base. He didn't have that kind of numbers. And if I could persuade the command at Etna Station to strike him first, he never would. That night we talked. "I don't know," BT said. "That's a pretty big detour, and we don't even know if she'll come out of hiding." "He's right, though," Tommy said. "What if she pulls something like my sister did?
If we can make her believe her success will be quick, thorough, and relatively safely done, she might not be able to help herself. Seems like getting to Aetna Station would be enough to stop her, if it's something she wants to do without risking herself. Double-edged sword, I said to BT. If she knows where we're going, she might get desperate, strike us soon, before we can get to that relative safe haven. You're overestimating her. She can't know all that. Tracy, he pleaded his case to the person who was the best by far at reeling me back when I began to dangle my feet over the edge. The large man has merit, Deneau said. Don't remember asking you, I said. She shrugged as she reached into her pocket for the ghost of cigarettes past. Well, looks like you're on the same side as Deneau. That should tell you something, I said to BT. Don't attack him, Lindsay said. Sis, I'm not attacking him. You weren't there. All those people, they never stood a chance. One pissed off vampire was able to do that. She had an army, BT said. Eliza was a whole shitload smarter than Payne. She knew her limitations and her strengths. She raised an army of the living and the dead to help her do her bidding. I'm sorry, man, but I don't see Payne being able to pull this off. You saw that zombie horde at Cemetery Hill? You can't deny that, I said. About that. He paused, looking around the room, and lowered his voice. If they were controlled by her, they were certainly acting strangely. There was enough of them, we would have had a hard time defending the fort. She had us right then, if she wanted. What do you mean, if? Look, maybe no one is controlling them. Maybe they are just evolving, I said. I realize you do not wish to hear from me, Michael, but it is December, Mrs. Deneau said. What's your point? If you're hoping I'll remember to put you on my gift list, you're tooting the wrong horn. Eloquent as always, she said. My point is, so far, we have had an incredible run of luck with the weather being so mild. We are talking about making a pass through the Rockies. What do you propose we do if we should get snowed in by a blizzard? Don't worry. If I go all Alfred Packer, I'm eating him first. I thumbed at BT. Gee, thanks, man, BT said. Who's Alfred Packer? Meredith asked. Colorado pioneer that ate his traveling companions when they got stuck in the mountains, Jess told her. Oh, gross, she said, gagging. There are no plows, Michael. It's December. There is most certainly snow on the roads through the Rockies. I knew she was right, which made me want to dig my heels in even more. Wait, wait, BT said. I've seen that look before. If you're dead set on this shit, okay, bad choice of words, I know a better place, and we don't have to go so far out of our way. Now you're agreeing with him, Lindsay asked. You know this man, right? He's going to do it anyway, aren't you? The last part was not a question. She has to be stopped. I can plead ignorance about what Eliza was going to do, that's fair enough, but it does little to ease my nightmares. I should have known, and knowing that now, how could I ever live with myself if I thought there was even a small chance Payne could do the same thing? God damn it. I hate it when he's right, BT said. Perhaps we swing up to Washington State and drop off those that cannot fight, Deneau said. Do not look at me that way, Michael. I fully intend on seeing this through. I would think it should ease your mind somewhat if only soldiers were involved in this. Soldiers? What are we talking about? Winters had come into the room. Quiet didn't even begin to convey the noiseless vacuum it had become in there. Real smooth, that's not too suspicious. I already have an inkling of what's going on, even if I think maybe all of you have lost your minds and this is some sort of collective hallucination. What is it you think you know, my dear? Deneau asked. That Mike had a run-in with what he is saying was a vampire at Gettysburg, and that you've had run-ins with vampires before. Sounds like something out of a TV show, and I'm sorry. I respect what you've all gone through and what you've survived, but I think that maybe the stress is beginning to take its toll. I sighed. Tommy, I looked over at the boy. You sure, Mr. T? He doesn't believe us, and I don't want him thinking we're all about to crack. Sure about
That was all Winters could get out before Tommy covered the distance of the room, appearing before Winters, teeth elongated, eyes red. "What the fuck?" he stumbled backwards, tripping and knocking over a chair, which he then stayed behind. He was looking from the floor up at Tommy, then to the rest of us. "What the fuck is he? This some sort of trick?" He was scrambling to get back up, holding his chair like a reluctant circus lion tamer. "I'm a vampire," Tommy said, extending his hand to help the man up, even as his fangs receded. "Bullshit," Winters said, but refused to reach out to Tommy. "Do we look like we're doing parlor tricks, Winters? That we have nothing better to do than scare each other? There's enough scary shit out there. I would hope we would be able to refrain from dangling fake spiders, especially with all the guns around," I said. BT had gone over to help Winters up. The Marine shrugged him off. Are you all vampires? Did you lure me and Brooke here just so, you know, you could eat you?" I said. "We're not all vampires," BT said, ignoring me and attempting to placate Winters, who looked like he was going to bolt from the room. "If we were all vampires and were evil, don't you think we would have just taken you all back in New Hampshire?" Winters thought on that, but having everything you think you know turned on its ear again takes a minute to go through. "Vampires aren't real," he said. "Yes, neither are zombies," Deneau cracked. "Oh, God, I would skin baby animals for a cigarette," she sighed. "I figured that would be something you did just for fun," BT replied quickly. We fist-bumped that one. "Are any others of you vampires?" he asked. I thought my heart was going to drop out. No one said anything, but invariably gazes shifted around, some looking at walls, the ceiling, all finally heading in my direction. "You too," he asked, picking up on my discomfort. "Half," I finally answered. "Enough to be burdened, but not so much that I can't push the reality of it away." Tommy had pulled away and was back at his original spot across the room. Winters realized this wasn't some huge conspiracy, and that if we'd wanted him dead, he would be, 100 times by now. "What were you talking about before I came in?" Winters asked, more like his normal self, though still suspicious. "Well, I guess you're in. Gonna need your help anyway," I said. "We're trying to set up a trap for the vampire that is following us before we get to Washington State." I laid out everything we had so far. He offered some suggestions as he moved past what he had just learned about his new group. I don't know if he'd ever feel safe around us again, and I wondered how this would affect us at Edna Station. If and when he rejoined a unit, I had to think the odds were pretty good he'd give us up. Maybe not even on purpose, just talking, as soldiers often do. It was later that night when I went over to see him. He didn't seem surprised about it. In fact, it seemed he even knew what I was there for, because he spoke first. "I love the Marine Corps," he said. I wasn't sure how that fit into the general discussion, but I let him speak. I also was thankful for all the Corps had done for me, for the swift kick in the ass that had righted my sinking ship. I loved the Marine Corps even more now that I was no longer active. The Marines we'd met had been nothing but honorable, courageous men. Many, like Winters, had gone to bat for us, even though we were strangers. And I will always love what they had done for our country. I let him continue. "Next week, if you can believe it, my regular enlistment is up." I was going to tell him I didn't think anyone would consider him a deserter at this point. He was without a unit and on the road with civvies, although he had been with Sanders. The Major was like a father to me, and I would have re-upped just to make him proud. But with Brooke depending on me, I want something different. I would like to try and have a family, a home, not go traipsing all over the world like I've seen the Major do. It might be a pipe dream, but I would like to shoot for a normal life, if such a thing even exists anymore. Or ever did, I added. I had no idea where he was going with this. "True," he smiled. "What I'm trying to say is that if they find out I was in the Marines and have experience in demolition, there's a very good chance that whatever military people are there
You're going to want me to stay in.
He looked directly at me. What kind of life are you hoping for there?
Then it dawned on me.
The same. The very same as you. I want my kids to have a chance. To live, to love, and grow. I don't want to keep fighting the rest of my life.
Your secret is safe with me. And you mean no one there harm, he asked.
I guess it was a fair question.
I do not, I told him sincerely.
Then your secret is safe with me, sir.
Then we're even.
And you might want to drop the sir. That's a dead giveaway you were a soldier. And quit shaving.
Chapter 15. Mike Journal Entry 15.
I don't know why the fates had eased up on us as we traveled closer to our destination. I could not get the feeling out of my head that they were storing everything up for one final blowback. The next day and a half were wholly unremarkable, which in itself made them extremely remarkable. It seemed we had hit the sweet spot for all things fiend, but they were on vacation, taking some time from all their monster duties. The Pacific Ocean. We've almost made it, I said to Tracy as I looked upon the sparkling jewel. I wanted to shout in joyful triumph, but we hadn't quite won. Maybe there were two outs in our Game 7 of the World Series and we were up by a run, but that didn't mean it was a done deal. I'd been a Red Sox fan long enough to know that. I'd celebrate. I'd celebrate hard when we made it to the other side. To do so early was foolhardy. It tempted fate, spurred the enemy on, and made any defeat that much more crushing. If you think you've already won, you let your guard down. You allow room for disaster, and opportunists will use that to their advantage. It is much more difficult to rebound, to reobtain what you assumed was yours. It's like that smug receiver that believes he has caught the winning touchdown. He looks for a fraction of a second at the camera, takes his eyes off the prize just long enough then to see the ball glance off his fingertips and out of bounds. A lot of mixed sports references here, but games are extremely applicable to life. We were first in gold to our goal, but that was still a Hail Mary from safe at home, or a touchdown. We stood at the scenic pullout as a group, taking it all in silence, each of us lost in thought. Then Henry took a shit. There we were, peering into the endless horizon, trying to figure out what was going to happen, what could happen. Then Henry took center stage, dropped his haunches, and let loose something that looked like he'd been building since Iowa. Laughter. Sweet laughter rang out from nearly all of us. Henry, after taking care of business, turned to admire his creation, then scraped the earth a few times with his hind legs in a vain attempt to hide it. "Gonna need a backhoe to bury that, buddy," I said to him as I crouched down. He came over and got his obligatory head scratch. Well, I guess that's his way of getting us moving. The breeze was coming off the ocean, and bringing with it Henry's odoriferous offering. Getting late. Do we maybe wait? BT asked. He was nervous. We all were. Confrontations were one thing. You dealt with them as they came. But forcing one was more difficult. I was almost of a mind to stall. Find a picturesque place on the beach and enjoy what could be our last night on the planet. I would have, too, if not for Riley. While we were all facing west and taking in the incredible sunset view, she was facing east, looking towards a small mountain ridge. The fur on her nape was sticking up. She wasn't growling exactly, but something in her, something instinctual, had her hackles raised. I had a good idea of what it was, and that was confirmed when Tommy turned as well, a questioning look on his face. We locked glances for a moment, and in that millisecond, we knew. She was out there, maybe watching remotely or just maybe close enough to be of concern. I didn't say anything. I wanted our exit to be as normal as could be. The less she knew we knew, the better. I didn't want to give her any reason to be suspicious of our activities. We were 20 miles from our objective, heading up the Oregon Coast Highway, easily one of the most beautiful roads I'd ever had the pleasure of being on. Would have loved to stop, snap 10,000 pictures, ooh and aah at every magnificent sight, maybe get some fried clams. The strips, not the bellies. That's just gross. But we weren't tourists. We were refugees, and it was sanctuary we sought. We wanted to lay our own trap, and not the tourist type. "Traffic's getting thicker," Tracy said. Honestly, I hadn't even noticed it. I was checking my six constantly, making sure our small convoy wasn't being followed and that everyone was on course. And when I wasn't looking in the rearview mirror, I was looking past Tracy to the rolling hills to our right, wondering when she was going to show herself. I could feel her now. She wanted me to feel her. She wanted me to be afraid. And in that, she was succeeding. Like a cold, black eel, she swam through the neurons of my mind, infecting everything in her path with her desire for revenge. Earth to Talbot, Tracy was about to flick me on the side of the head, but I turned at the last moment and she nearly poked me in the eye. Huh? Cars. There's more of them on the road. Maybe if you actually looked ahead, you could see them. She was right. About the cars, I mean. Well, and the need to look forward more, I guess, too. Just 20 miles ago, it was rare to see anything. Occasionally, there would be a vehicle on the side of the road as if it had broken down and was now long forgotten. Now both sides of the two-lane highway had cars. I was dodging continuously, and traveling was slower. From what I could see up ahead, it was only getting thicker. Deneau flashed her lights to signify she wanted me to stop. She pulled up alongside. "This could be problematic," she said, referring to the cars. It wasn't snow, but it might as well be. Inaccessible was inaccessible, any way you looked at it. Must have been some sort of evacuation route. Whatever struck here, it was quick, she said. And how would you know that? Might have been a hint of peevish in there, only because we were making our bed and I really wanted to lie in it. But now we might have to deal with a serious case of bed bugs before we could get between the sheets. Well, that, and it was Deneau, our not-that-necessary evil. She didn't say anything for a moment, then pursed her lips. "You haven't noticed." "He hasn't noticed?" she asked again, looking past me into Tracy. "I don't think so," she replied. "What did we miss?" Deneau pointed to the car slightly ahead and to my left. There was a zombie peering through the rear windshield. When it had been human, he had been around 8 years old. What was left of his parents looked to be scattered all over the dashboard, and I would imagine strewn throughout the entire car. "Lately, more cars than not have had zombies in them," she said. "What? Why?" I was now looking around. There were 10 cars visible. 7 of them had movement inside. Safe to say it wasn't of a human variety. I turned the car off and got out. The percentages stayed fairly consistent as I checked more and more. "How can this be?" I asked anyone willing to venture an answer. "I believe Portland was one of the first places on the West Coast to receive flu shots," Deneau said. "When it hit, perhaps they were evacuating." "How do you know that?" I asked her. Like I said, Deneau is as smooth as butter when it comes to concealing the truth, so I don't know if I absolutely believed her, but she gave a valid response. There was an article in the Denver Post in regards to it. "I was very upset that Denver had not received theirs yet," she replied. "Here, though, why would they evacuate Oregon by 101? No one uses coastal roads if they're trying to get anywhere fast," BT said. "I don't know. None of this makes sense. We've talked about this before. None of us got a warning about the zombies. One second I'm taking a shower during a typical work night, and the next there's zombies. What did these people know?" "Uncle," Meredith said, "most of these cars have blue stickers on the front windshield." She was looking around, but careful not to move quickly or get too close. The zombies would be thrown into a fever pitch if any of us did. They would slap their hands and heads against the windows in desperate bids to get to us. Once you've seen it, you don't need a replay. Military identification. They're coming from a base somewhere.
I found a car with a small kid zombie. I didn't feel like he'd be able to bust through the safety glass. "Coast Guard," I said, once I was able to read the print on the sticker. "Another red National Guard." Made sense. From what we know, the military had been the first to get the tainted shot. Also made sense they'd be the first trying to protect their families and get away from